I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anilio, and you're listening to The Functional Nerds, episode number 159. And John, if it's not broke, don't fix it.
That's what I say. That is Patrick. He is an author, a blogger, and a podcast dude. You can check out his website, atfmb.com, and follow him on Twitter, at atfmb.
John, I think from now on, I want you to say Hugo nominated in front of all that.
Well, hopefully, maybe the next time we record, I'll be able to say Hugo winner.
That'd be
Hugo
cool,
winner,
it?
Yeah.
DiNardo thinks his ego got inflated by that. You just wait.
I won't even be on the show. I won't even be on the show anymore. It'll be Patrick Hester's Functional Nerds. What I'm really hoping to do though is I hope you win, and then that way when I introduce our podcast, I can sort of say it in such a way where it sounds like we won it, even though we've never even been close to being nominated. But I'm going to work on that if you win. So hopefully you win.
Here's the best case scenario: Hugo win, and then Mer Lafferty wins the Campbell Award.
Oh,
because then I'm the Hugo Award winning, and I'm also the producer of the Campbell Award winning. I should be right.
God, yeah.
I'll be able, any bar in any town that has a science fiction community that actually is listening to podcasts, I will never have to pay more than half price for a drink.
Oh, yeah. And your ego is going to be out of control. Like when we do these podcasts and the video, you're not even going to look at the camera. You're going to turn your head away the whole time.
I always have my sunglasses on. Yeah.
So that's Patrick, and my name is John Anilio, and I always got to get through it. I'm going to power through it no matter what you do. I'm a singer-songwriter and a composer, and you can check out my music over at johnanilio.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at John Anilio. And our guest today is David Annandale. He's the author for the Black Library of the Warhammer 40K books, The Death of Antigonus. Oh boy, I probably screwed that up already. Yarrick, Chains of Golgotha, Mephiston, Lord of Death. His horror novel, damn it. Say it for me, David. I already lost
Get
it.
Gethsemane Hall.
Gethsemane Hall was published last year by Dundurn Press and in the UK by Snow Books. For Turnstone Press, he has written a series of thrillers featuring rogue warrior Jen Blaylock. He also writes nonfiction about movies and video games. He teaches film, creative writing, and literature at the University of Manitoba. You can check out David's website, davidannandale.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at David_Annandale. And he is a regular on Skiffy and Fanty's Shoot the Wisb, WISB podcast. David, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm really sorry that I just destroyed that whole bio. I usually mess up once. I think I messed up like four or five times in there. So
And what's your excuse, John? Because I mean, I've only had two cups of coffee, but I'm curious what your excuse is.
I have a learning disability where I don't read well. I don't know.
My last name has defied spelling and pronunciation for my life, so we could probably blame that.
Yeah.
It's the added element.
That's funny because I just, John and I were talking with Nick, what was his last name? Nick
Minuti
about names and different things. And John brought up Max Brooks. And are you familiar with Max Brooks? He's the son of Mel Brooks. He's the guy who wrote the World War Z stuff. Well, and then you've got Albert Brooks, who is the comedian who's been in a lot of different movies and different things. I heard an interview with a guy. He's an author. He's got a book out. And I forget his complete name. It's like Alex Brooks or something like that. Mm-hmm. But through a string of events and circumstances, he found himself at this charity dinner sitting at a table with Albert Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
And he said something along the lines of, "You have no idea how hard it's been my entire life. Everybody always confuses my name with yours and calls me Albert."
Mm.
And he said something along the lines of, he said, like, Albert Brooks just looked at him and he says, "Well, how do you think Adolf Pretzler felt?" Or something like that, you know, Adolf. And it was just, people, they screw the names up all the time. It happens. If you search my name on Amazon, you get all this weird, like, Civil War. There's like these documents or something from the Civil War, and there's a Patrick Hester throughout all of them. I don't know. It's like weird. It's just weird.
Mm. you know, it's funny with Albert Brooks, that's not his real name. Do you know what his real name is?
Is it Mel?
No, it's there. His last name is Einstein. Like he's, no, I'm not making it up. He's Einstein. I don't know if Albert is his real first name too, but, and his brother, Albert Brooks's brother is actually Super Dave Osborne. And his last name is Einstein. Do you remember Super Dave mm-hmm. Osborne from like yeah. David Letterman? Super Dave Osborne and Albert Brooks are brothers.
I don't remember him from David Letterman, but I remember him from Bizarre.
Yeah, he was a regular on Letterman in the early days, I guess, and he'll still come on once in a while. But so they're brothers, and their real last name is Einstein.
I just want you to understand, John, that story would have been a lot cooler if his first name had actually been Mel.
Mel Einstein?
No, not that. So what does any of this have to do with David?
Nothing. We're just we've gone off the rails earlier than normal. But,
rails? I don't see any rails from where we're sitting.
There's no rails here.
There's no rails here. We're in space now. It's like it's like there's no gravity. We're just spinning.
Yeah.
Poor David is sitting there going, "What have I gotten myself into?"
Well, you know, it's funny how it's probably better if you're on the Functional Nerds if you're not kind of a friend on Twitter, because I feel because we just had Nick Minuti on the show and we didn't really know him before we talked to him, and he was really
so
friendly. But like we were just like, I think, on our best behavior, and you know, we're a little, you know, but it's like, oh, I talk to David every day on Twitter, like he's fine, and now I'm just totally rambled.
He'll put up with us.
Yeah.
We're trying to come up with something clever to say in all this.
Why should you? We haven't yet, so. Well, anyway, let's actually try to get some form to the show. Why don't we get on to our picks of the week?
Picks of the week.
David, considering Patrick and I were just dominating with useless chatter, why don't you go first with your pick of the week?
Well, my pick is an app for the iPad. It's called Index Card. And I've been constantly looking for ways to make the iPad more useful to me as a writer. And though Patrick is probably going to burn me at the stake for saying this, I don't use Scrivener. My writing style, once I actually start a book, is very linear, and everything has to be in Word documents. So, but for outlining, up until very recently, I still used a system that I derived from Sid Field, which involves using physical index cards to in the preliminary stages to get the outline done. And I was sticking to the physical form because I liked having all the index cards laid out before me on the floor. I could see the whole thing in one go. But this index card app for the iPad gets very close to having them all at one go. It has all the tactile qualities of the actual index cards. You can flip them around, add all kinds of notes. It's I've found it actually more useful than the physical. And so for the last couple of books, I've been using it. So it's just a few bucks.
And they are working on a Scrivener version for iPad. So you will actually have the index card ability, which is part of Scrivener.
Yeah, no, and I realize that I know that's been part of it, and I've sometimes toyed with the idea of trying it on the PC. It's just since my entire life has to be in Word document, and I've finally gone through the process of teaching myself Word, the idea of getting into something where there might be any kind of conversion or compatibility issues frightens me away, whereas just this one isolated feature, the index card, I've found enormously useful.
I will say this. With Scrivener, I'm not trying to bust.
I enjoy it because you're such an evangelist for it, and I think it's funny, and I think you should really contact them and on the show.
And they know my name at this point. You know, the developers like send me emails. It's hilarious. Mm-hmm. I was just gonna say, with Scrivener and the index card feature, it works better on a big screen.
Mm-hmm.
I fully admit that, because if you want to do what David's talking about doing, if you want to actually have everything laid out on index cards and be able to move them around and adjust them and do stuff, the bigger the screen, the better, really. Mm. because then you can you can actually see what you've typed on them. You can see all the stuff. You know, if you're on a smaller screen, obviously the cards are going to be smaller. And what happens is, let's say you've written a synopsis of what this particular scene or chapter is going to be. Well, it's going to get cut off on the smaller screen with the smaller cards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then the nice thing about the iPad app is that, though obviously the cards are small, so that you can fit, I think, at least a dozen visible on the screen without any kind of scrolling, that they're perfectly adequate to the sentence or two that is that is part of this particular outline process. I don't need more than a sentence or so. So I can get, I'd say, 80% of my outline visible immediately. And in the end, I found it just the minimal scrolling that I had to do and the ability to have much more detailed notes on the other sides of the cards, like almost you know, I could fit pages there if I wanted to elaborate on characters and stuff for when I'm actually then composing the actual outline. Absolutely invaluable.
And the other thing, John, is that even though I am a Scrivener evangelist and I do love the program, and I think it works for you no matter how you write. If you're an outliner, it's got that. If you like the index cards, it's got that. If you're linear, you can do it that way. If you're not linear, you don't have to. I mean, it's a very flexible program. But I'm not going to force anybody to use something that's going to kill their flow or their ability to work. You know, there's lots of folks out there who use other methods, or they're so tied into the way they use Word that to change for them would kill their productivity. And I'm not about that, you know. So to those folks out there who aren't using Scrivener, even though you're stupid, I don't really hold it against you in any way.
I had two questions about the app, David. Can you use a stylus with it? Do you write with it, or are you just typing with it?
I'm just typing with it. Okay. Yeah, it uses the virtual typewriter.
And it's just called Index Card?
Index Card, yeah.
Okay, cool. I may check that out. Very cool. So Patrick, what is your pick this week?
My pick this week is going to be, I went to Walmart to get the oil changed in my car because it's less expensive at Walmart, and like everything else at Walmart, and probably they bring the oil in from China. I don't know, but I went there, and right next to the automotive department is the electronics department, which is insidious, and evil, like Walmart, and so. While my car was getting its oil changed, I'm kind of wandering around, and I came across and ended up buying the first season DVD of Homeland. And this is a show that's on HBO, or not HBO, so it's Showtime. And I've never had Showtime. You know, I don't subscribe to Showtime and never have. And Showtime doesn't put their stuff out like the other networks. I've never seen Showtime original series like on Netflix, for example.
Homeland is on Netflix now.
Is it on Netflix now? Well, that's
for the DVDs or for the streaming?
For the streaming.
Is it? Because I've never seen it on there.
My wife and I just watched it the other week.
Did it just come up on that? Because
I think it's new now. And also know that in Canada and the States, the offerings are a little bit different. So
Yeah.
So that might be on Canada, but not
it
the
could
States,
be on Canada.
Though usually your selection is much better than ours. So I assumed if we have it, you do too.
No,
but I could be wrong.
Last time I checked, it's not on there. So that was one of the reasons why I've been wanting to watch it for a while. And I mean, everybody probably remembers Claire Danes from like My So-Called Life. I've never really liked anything she's done since then, but I'm not through the entire season yet, but I'm really enjoying her character and what they're doing with this, with Homeland. And it's a very intriguing premise and it's really intense and it's a really good show. And if you're into that kind of stuff, it's well worth your time. You've got Claire Danes, you've got the guy with the red hair. He's been in a lot of like weird quirky shows.
The guy from Life, I think he was.
Yeah,
in
Life
show
was one of the shows. Yeah.
Damian Lewis.
You've got what's her face from Firefly Serenity is in it. She plays the wife. She was also the alien in V. I can't remember her name now all of a sudden.
Monica
Bereckin or
Marina, I believe.
Yeah.
I think her name is Marina. Yeah, she was in V too.
Yeah, she's in that. I mean, it's a really good intense show, and so I'm enjoying it so far.
And I just looked; it's not on Netflix streaming in the States.
I didn't think it was.
So it must be.
I've never seen anything from Showtime on Netflix. here.
Yeah, it's all that right stuff is really tricky. Some stuff they have and some they don't. You know?
Okay, so that's why we've been starting to get seasons of Dexter and so forth showing up on that, which surprised me when those appeared.
Yeah, I can't remember. I think Dexter, actually, now that you mentioned, I think Dexter was on Netflix, but I don't think it is anymore.
Yeah, I think I remember seeing it, and I don't think it's there now. So, well, that's cool. Cool. Mm-hmm. My pick this week is because we were talking about...
And John, I just apologize for one second. But the premise of the show is the guy is a war hero. I should have actually said this. The guy is like he's a soldier, and he's been missing and presumed dead for years. And when a CIA team or something of soldiers break into this room, they find him. And, you know, he's been a prisoner for like 8 years, and they bring him home. And now the CIA and the NSA and everybody's wondering, you know, was he turned? You know, did he give up secrets? And so now that he's home, you've got like the politicians wanting him to be a hero and talking about how great the war is and how we're doing all this great stuff overseas. You've got the CIA and NSA kind of wondering, is he a terrorist now? So that's the premise of the show, and that's why it's so intense and cool. So I apologize for interrupting you, but I forgot to actually say what the premise of the show was.
It was originally an Israeli TV series.
It was,
and,
yes.
Very, very heavy influence from the Manchurian Candidate.
Prisoner of War, I believe, is the Israeli series.
Cool, cool. Well, if that comes on Netflix in the States, then maybe I'll watch it.
So anyway.
My pick this week is Born Standing Up. It is Steve Martin's autobiography, a memoir of his time as a stand-up comedian. It was one of the Amazon Kindle daily deals, or maybe it was just on sale for a month. So I picked it up a while ago for like $1.99 or $2.99. It's not even that I'm the hugest Steve Martin fan. Anytime I'm into memoirs, and I'm into, especially if they're about creative life or performing life, and that's what this is about, and I loved it. It was great. It's a pretty short book. It's only like about 210 pages, and he basically recounts his time from being a kid up until really his movie career takes off. So it's basically from then till The Jerk, basically, and talking about his development as a comedian and as a writer. And it's really interesting, and he's really quite a good writer. It really conveys his thoughts, and it just had me thinking a lot about different aspects of the creative process kind of the whole 10,000 hours thing. He worked at Disneyland from the time he was a little kid. Like, he started selling programs, and then he worked in as a magician, and then in the theater, and then he worked in Knott's Berry Farms doing like five shows a day. And it just really goes to show you, like, a lot of times when people who are successful in the arts, it's practice. It's just, you know, and he did that for years and years and years. And he was a writer on the Smothers Brothers show in the 60s. And it's just really an interesting read. And one of the other writers on the show was Super Dave Osborne. He and Super Dave were writers on the Smothers Brothers show. But that's how I remembered, because I remember hearing that about Albert Brooks. But I think Super Dave's name, his name's not Dave, it's like Howard or something. It's like Howard Einstein or something like that. But anyway, if you're into the creative process, it's definitely a book worth reading, and it's obviously funny because Steve Martin's a kind of a funny guy, so there's like funny little stories here and there too, and it's worth a read. So Born Standing Up, Steve Martin, I recommend it. So let's get on to our main topic today. So let's talk today about horror novels. So David has a horror novel coming out. And, you know, a couple weeks ago we talked about horror movies with Chris F. Holm. And today we're going to focus a little more on the literature side of horror novels. So, you know, David, why don't you give it a start? Like, what's, you know, you write the Warhammer stuff, and you write the horror novels as well. So do you keep these two pursuits separate, and how do you go about writing, and how do you get started with horror?
Well, horror's been part of my life for basically most of my life. I've always been fascinated by monsters, and I think in nursery school, all my drawings were just black scribbles, right? When I got my first horror movie book in grade three, that was the real entry level drug, and so it's always been my great love. And as far as the writing is concerned, well, I've So I've had horror fiction published. Well, I guess my first sales were back in the 90s, but I was also coming of age as a novelist in the 90s, which was a very, very, very bad time for horror. That was the decade of the Great Implosion, and it was very hard to sell something. And so that was at the end of the 90s is when I shifted into thrillers and made my first sales there. So Gethsemane Hall was kind of my return to horror. With the Warhammer 40,000 stuff, one of the things I love about 40K is that it's almost like all of my favorite genres in one spot, and this very fruitful fusion of them. And so I do, in some of the stories and novels I write for them, I have this very pronounced horror elements in them. So it's not always necessary. I guess I don't think of it so much as a split, so much as what the individual story will demand, as opposed to when I'm writing a full-on horror novel like Gethsemane Hall, where the whole focus of the book is to terrify the reader.
Now, as a reader, who are some of the novelists that you enjoyed reading that sort of maybe inspired you to write horror?
Well, it's going to be probably some fairly familiar names here. Certainly, Poe, Lovecraft, Stephen King were among the early influences. Peter Straub's Ghost Story, I think, is still one of the most incredible horror novels ever written. Shirley Jackson, Kathy Koja. We're all Clive Barker. Oh, and Ramsey Campbell in particular, he taught me so much about style. Those would certainly be a lot of the formative influences.
Now, being someone who doesn't really read much horror, any horror that I read is usually like you said with your Warhammer 40K stuff, it's usually some sort of fusion with science fiction, like there's an element of horror in it or a fusion with fantasy. But you know, I know just from reading so much fantasy, a lot of fantasy is based on the hero's journey, and there's a certain kind of form to it, and there are certain characteristics to it. So what, for a horror novel, what do you think are some of the, I don't want to say cliches of it, but what are some of the things that you often see from novel to novel? Like what's sort of a structure like that may be different than, say, science fiction or fantasy?
Well, that's a really good question, because people have struggled with defining horror as a genre forever. And I think one of the problems is that it isn't really a genre. I mean, if we look at the history of horror, it's changed so much from time period to time period, right? If we look at the very first horror novels, which were the Gothic novels of the 18th century, so The Castle of Otranto, The Mysteries of Udolpho, The Monk, they bear virtually no resemblance to the horror novels of today. And yet we know they are still the same, you know, working in the same field. So there are certain elements that will pop up that may be common from one decade or century to the next, but not necessarily. So we'll see certain periods where, for instance, particularly when Stephen King hit it big, there was a flood of scary New England town novels, right? Where they, hopefully with die-cut paperbacks, where there's, you know, you open it up and there's a scarier picture inside, where a couple with a young child leaves the big city to the small town, and all kinds of bad things happen. Whereas in England, around the same time when James Herbert was hitting big, we suddenly got a flood of nature gone berserk novels imitating the rats. So I think what will happen with horror is that it'll adopt the forms, it'll address whatever the successful horror, I should say, will address the anxieties of its particular time. And so one of the reasons why it changes so much, and it's hard to nail it down, and it's also parasitic, so that when you look at its role in science fiction or fantasy or any of the other hybrids out there, when you get into a discussion as to, well, is Alien, say, science fiction or horror? Well, in some ways, that's like asking whether the sun is yellow or round, right? Mm-hmm. It's a false distinction. So horror will be almost like a bundle of tactics, whatever will work to get at the reader, whatever, or viewer, whatever happens to be powerful at that time. Having said that, there are, of course, these tropes that get established. And well, for instance, with Gethsemane Hall, that was my visit to the classic horror novel. Haunted House novel. I've loved Haunted House stories for all my life, wanted to do one of my own. And so I wanted to take the classic form of the isolated house, the investigators who go in, and then, of course, you have to figure out some halfway decent reasons to why these idiots don't leave once the scary stuff starts happening. And so then you get all the other tropes of the, you know, the secret passage and the haunted past and so forth that all come into play with that particular subcategory of the horror novel.
So would you say that with as opposed to something like fantasy, that horror is more just kind of a feeling that people get, like it should be scary. Like that's, I mean, is that what defines horror? I mean,
in some ways, yeah, I remember having a bit of a discussion with on Twitter about this with some others as a mode or a collection of strategies designed to frighten the reader. And I guess I would identify a story or a novel, a film as being horror once those strategies become dominant. Right, so whatever the other trappings of the book are, whether it's in space or in the far west or in an urban center, and whatever the other themes are, because there's going to be, of course, all sorts of ideas and concerns that often come with horror. But if this work has as one of its primary goals to create fear in the reader, then it's a horror novel. In some ways, those tactics, the parasitic, the parasite is completely taken over the host, would be another way of putting it.
That's interesting. And, you know, we were talking about, we'd mentioned this, these hybrids, and I just thought about how I haven't read much horror, but I have read quite a few books that have vampires in them. And right. And I guess, you know, that's another almost whole genre unto itself. And I would venture a guess to say that most or many vampire or novels that have vampires as characters are not horror these days. You know, they're
romance.
They're romance or they're urban fantasy. I've read a lot of things with vampires, and like, I'm not well read in horror, but it doesn't strike me as being horror. I wasn't ever scared. One of my favorite books was the Vampire Empire series by Clay and Susan Griffiths, and it's a great book and not sparkly vampires a la Twilight at all, but I don't think it's horror. I would not describe it as horror whatsoever. So what are your feelings about that? I mean, because you could probably even point to other things that were once associated with horror that maybe fantasy, urban fantasy, romance sort of took from horror. You know, what do you feel about that?
No, I think you're absolutely right, and it's a very tangled history, because we look again back to the Gothic novel of the 18th century. You a lot of those have a lot of the elements that we then see in romance, right? And so in the paranormal romance or the some of the more Gothic romances, there's a very old school, tradition that is operating there, and we could almost say that horror and romance were joined at the hip. At least if we go far enough back. But you're absolutely right that all the examples that you gave, there are so many stories with vampires in them that are clearly not meant to frighten the reader. The vampires are the protagonists much of the time. Or it's more action-oriented, whatever, you know, Underworld is not really horror. It's action and so forth. So, I think it points to the difficulty in defining horror by its content or by the figures that show up in them, because as you said, a lot of those vampire stories are not horror, though the vampire begins in horror, and we still get horror vampire stories in things like 28 Days Later. 30 Days of Night.
I don't know. So, I think Twilight was pretty horrible. No, I'm kidding. I actually am still 100% Twilight free.
Yeah, I haven't read it yet. But keep going, David. Sorry.
Yeah, no. So so the elements can be used in all these different ways, and it's how those elements are used. So yeah, we've seen a huge evolution of the vampire character, seeing it itself deployed in all kinds of different ways, and the same thing with the werewolf and so on. I think really with the explosion of urban fantasy, we're seeing a lot of the characters that we might think of as horror tropes, or that used to be associated with them. With horror, that are being used in other ways now.
Well, you know what's interesting is, I remember when the movie was made, The Interview with the Vampire, and there was lots of people, you know, freaking out over Tom Cruise playing Lestat. And I had never read any of those books before, but I was curious about them, you know, since they were making this movie, and I found out there were so many different, you know, books that Anne Rice had written on these vampires, the Vampire Chronicles. So I decided to go and pick one up. So I go to the bookstore and I go to the horror section, and I cannot find them anywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's because they were not in the horror section. They were in literature.
Mm.
That happened.
Do you see what I'm getting at? Yeah. It's like I totally would think a vampire book at that time would be horror, but it was in literature.
And you went looking for that around the time the film came out, right?
Yep.
So that was also during that terrible implosion I was mentioning earlier. Because the other factor that was happening then is that horror was not selling at all. And so if you wanted to sell something, you didn't call it horror. And bookstores were getting rid of horror sections.
Yeah, I don't think there is a horror section anymore.
Well, there's been a bit of a resurgence. It's better than it once was. So you can I did see the return of horror sections to bookstores, not as big as they once were, but writers like Anne Rice and Stephen King migrated very quickly into the fiction sections when anybody who had been in the horror section then went into those areas. But, of course, King and Rice, so popular, so prolific, that if, depending on the bookstore, if you put them in the horror section, they'd be the entire horror section.
Interesting.
Definitely. Well, I think that is a good place to wrap it up this week. So, David, why don't you tell us, so obviously you have your novels coming out, so why don't you tell our listeners what you have coming out, and once again, you can check out David's website, davidannandale.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at David_Annandale. And so what do you have coming out, David?
Well, I am working on a follow-up to Gethsemane Hall, but more immediately are some more books with the Black Library and the Warhammer 40,000 line. There's a lot of projects I can't actually the details I cannot reveal as of yet, but
do it.
I am authorized to mention that I have written a novel about Commissar Yarik, and so that will be something coming out fairly soon. Watch this space, to speak metaphorically.
All right, very good. I'm sorry.
Website,
I already gave him that, but why don't you say any appearances coming up? Any cons you're going to be going to?
Nothing for the rest of the summer. A few things that are pending, so I'll. But nothing I can announce officially yet.
All right. All right. Very. for me this week, just check out my website, johnanilio.com. You can follow me on Twitter at johnanilio. Patrick, what would you like to tell our listeners this week?
Well, atfmb.com, twitter.com/atfmb. Hopefully I tweeted a ton of stuff from Worldcon, because we're recording this before Worldcon. Astounding Space Thrills over at Kirkus. Also over at Kirkus is the Jim Butcher reviews, and then I've got a review of Justice League, the Flashpoint Paradox DVD over at SF Signal.
Very good. All right, everybody. Well, thanks for joining us this week, and we will talk to you next time.
We don't actually talk to them, John.
We'll talk at you next time.
Sunsmoke.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.
Still here?
It's over. Go home. Go.